We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Well, it is Thanksgiving week, and I hope that all of you are very thankful for what the Lord has been doing, not only in this nation, but hopefully in your lives individually as we continue to seek His face and we continue to search the Scriptures every morning to live out our Christian lives according to His Word and His promises. So there's a lot of news to get to as well over the weekend. So California is still counting votes. It's absolutely ridiculous that Donald Trump has filled his entire cabinet before the state of California has finished counting. I mean, this is just remarkably absurd. And now there is rumor that Kamala Harris, remember her? I mean, yeah, that's like a blast from the past, right? Is actually thinking about running for governor from the state of California. They're trying to make her a thing, and it's just not happening. So now, Caitlyn Jenner, who, you know, was formerly Bruce Jenner, still a guy, by the way, is now considering running against Kamala Harris. And California just has major problems, clearly, in all kinds of ways. And a lot of that stems from the utter depravity of the LGBTQ agenda that has taken over a lot of what is going on in that state. But that has also infected a lot of other states. And this is what, of course, voters in 2024, I think, resoundingly rejected when we said we want to live in reality. We want to live in truth and have completely rejected the LGBTQ agenda. And that gets me to our first guest, who has been on a fight for the last several years to get books out of children's schools that not only have a very graphic LGBTQ content, but should never, ever be in a public school curriculum, should not be in public school libraries, and absolutely should not be given to children or have children have access to them. So Stacy Langton is a mom. Her website is mamagrizzly.org, and she hails from Northern Virginia. And Stacy, the Fox News headline says, Virginia mother declares victory after school system quietly removes X-rated LGBTQ graphic novel. What happened here? And congratulations.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it, Jenna. And, you know, yeah, it's a small victory. It's a start. And, you know, we're in a long battle here in the culture war, right? This is the final battle, as President Trump likes to call it. And we're going to take this win. Now, the thing about it is I didn't even know I had won. And that's because the Fairfax County Public School System removed this book, and they did it very quietly. I brought it to their attention at a school board meeting on May 11th of 2023. And this particular book is so vile, it's so deviant, and it's so perverse that the images that are in the book couldn't be broadcast on the airwaves because it would violate our federal obscenity laws under the FCC. And you could not publish the images in a newspaper in this country. So that's the gravity and seriousness of what we're talking about here, which our children are being exposed to. And if I may, I would like to describe as politely as I can for your listeners the worst image, which I printed out on a piece of, you know, poster board, and I showed it to the school board. And this image shows a heterosexual couple a set of parents having sex, except the gender roles are reversed. So the father is on all fours and the mother is wearing a strap-on device and dad is on the receiving end. So that is how sick this indoctrination of our children has become in our nation's schools.
That is vile and not even something, you know, as a grown woman, I would ever want to look at. And clearly that is not appropriate for anyone, anyone at all, but certainly not for kids under the age of 18. And this book was in the library. And yet, according to this Fox article, this book was removed by librarians due to the outdated terminology that's no longer used in the LGBTQ community. I mean, so they're saying that what it needs to be more graphic and sorry, we apologize. I mean, this doesn't really seem like an apology.
Right. So, yeah, it's a non-explanation or a non-apology. And honestly, I don't know what they mean by that. So this was discovered quite by accident on October 24th when I went to the school board meeting to speak. And this was the last school board meeting before the election. And they tried to block me from speaking. And the reason was because I had submitted my testimony via video. You can either go to the podium or you can submit a video. And if you're submitting a video, it's 48 hours in advance, and then they have to approve it. So they know what you're going to say. Well, what I wanted to say and what I ended up getting to say was that, hey, when we all go into the voting booth on November 5th, next Tuesday, we're all going to pull the lever for President Trump, and it's going to be the biggest collective FU ever in recorded human history. I paraphrased, Michael Moore's famous phrase from 2016. And they didn't like that very much. They didn't want me talking about President Trump or the election, and they tried to block me from speaking. And they sent me an email saying, hey, we're not going to play your video tonight. And I was like, this is like 20 minutes before the meeting starts. And I'm like, well, what are you talking about? Like, why would they do that? It makes no sense. And that accidentally, through the course of the emails, revealed, they said, well, that book that you mentioned in your speech is not in the system. And that was a lie. It is in the system because it came from my son's high school. I went and checked the book out of the library. And when I checked it out, I took a bunch of photographs of the display because they had a very prominent LGBTQ collection that they wanted to display. And it, it had a big rainbow sign over it and it said, try an LGBT book, like, here, kiddies, try some porn, try some gay porn, try some straight porn. Like, it's insane what they are promoting and selling to our schools. And so that's what kind of kicked off this sequence of events. And it turned out when I spoke about it and showed it to the board back in May of 2023, it was essentially removed in less than a month. And it was removed across the entire district. Every school that it was housed in, all of the librarians removed it. And I thought, why would they do that, right? And what does outdated terminology mean? So I have a meeting tomorrow with the superintendent of Fairfax County Public Schools, Dr. Michelle Reed, and I intend to get some answers because they did not explain in the email what they mean by outdated terminology. But I like your analogy. Does it mean it's, not graphic enough? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I'll be very interested to hear their explanation. So you'll have to follow up with us and let us know the outcome of that meeting, because it seems like this is exactly where these types of absolutely absurd school boards are going, is that they're pulling this knowing that it's bad, but they don't want the LGBTQ mafia to come after them. So they make this kind of excuse and like, oh, this isn't good enough for all of you. And so it's like they're trying to appease both sides, and clearly they can't. So ultimately, I mean, what was the response to this, giant cardboard picture that you had mentioned previously? I mean, any rational person, the image that you described, that would be utterly offensive, even if we were talking about graphic content for a regular library. I mean, this was the type of stuff that, you used to have to show an ID and pay for, and it was very embarrassing, way back in the day, the 1950s and all this stuff. But but now it's like it's just regularly open. And especially for children, I mean, there's no way that they could have possibly answered that this is okay.
And the part of this particular book and this title, the name of the book is called Queer, A Graphic History by Meg John Barker. And what makes it actually rather dangerous for children is it was on top of this display. You know, there were about 20 different books profiled on the display. And you would not know that it was illustrated unless you picked the book up and flipped through it. And that's what I did. You know, I was just standing there and I thought, oh, what's this book? And I, you know, picked it up and started flipping through it. And there's 6 or 8 illustrations in that book that are completely X-rated. They are depictions Wow. of sex acts. And that one just happened to be the worst, which I printed out, you know, to show to the school board. And when I showed it to the school board, you know, I'm only standing maybe 30 feet away at the podium where they are on the dais. And their eyes were just, you know, like they were shocked. I don't think they knew that this was what was in this book. So it was a bridge too far, even for them. And they're all Democrats, you know, like they're all really strong liberals. But this is the thing I find in my travels when I'm, you know, on this fight for the last 3 years. When I go places in the public and talk with people about what it really is, what, you know, like if I say to a Democrat, like, hey, have you actually seen the images? And oftentimes they have not. And when I show them the images, like here's what was in Genderqueer back in 2021 when I exposed it. Here's what was in Queer, A Graphic History in 2023 when I exposed it. And when Democrats see that, they always have a visceral reaction to it, right? Because parents are parents everywhere they go, no matter, you know, what their sort of political affiliation is. And they have a reaction to a pornographic image just like anybody would, which is, yeah, I'm not okay with that, right? Most people do not want their children to have access to literal X-rated pornography. And that's what this is. And so that's why I've said from the beginning, this isn't really a political issue, right? This is about right versus wrong. And this isn't something that should be, you know, exposed to children. And it's illegal, right? Like, I keep coming back to that. Why is nobody addressing the obvious? It is against the law to put pornography in the presence of minors. It's against the law at the federal level. It's on the DOJ's website. And there's even a section of the law, the statute, as it is written, that says you cannot show cartoon line drawings of sex to children. So how does that magically become legal on a school campus inside the school library?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because you know, just because the school board is doing this and deciding that these books are okay, that doesn't exempt them from the law. And that's an absolutely excellent right. point. And hopefully more people are following up on this. And, you know, I wonder where is our law enforcement? And hopefully with the new DOJ and Pam Bondi, who I think is an excellent choice by President Trump for attorney general, you know, some of this can start being enforced, but even on the local level as well. I mean, this isn't just something that parents should have to fight. This should also be law enforcement. But also, you know, Stacey, as you were mentioning, there is such a visceral reaction. And I know even from listeners today, I know this is probably not the topic that you thought you would wake up at the 8 a.m. for, but this reminds me of the visceral reaction to abortion as well, and why the left will never show yeah. what an abortion actually looks like, because it is so heinous. It's so disgusting. We all have the law right. of God written on our hearts. And so even yep. the left, they're still human beings made in the image of God, even if they do not acknowledge our Creator. And they still have a visceral reaction to the culture of death and the culture of utter obscenity and all of this disgusting, disturbing nonsense. And so for you to put this in front of them and say, listen, is this really what you want to show children? That type of reaction, they can't help it. And they know the truth. And so I really appreciate you you fighting this fight, because it is one of the fights that we need to protect our children and hopefully protect our culture. How can people engage with you and support you in this fight?
Well, if you'd like to, you can follow me on Twitter or X, and my handle is at MamaGrizzly.org, O-R-G, and it's M-A-M-A, MamaGrizzly.org. And then I also have a website, which is MamaGrizzly.org. And I do need support in this fight because, you know, it's been 3 years. I have been in this fight for 3 years with the school district, and it's a brutal one. And quite honestly, yeah. My family has been put through a lot over the last 3 years. I've had a lot of very negative things happened to me as a result of speaking up and exposing these books. And there's been a lot of attacks, you know, in the very beginning, right before the gubernatorial election here in Virginia for Glenn Youngkin. And, you know, obviously he used my original school board appearance in a campaign ad to great effect, right? And it helped get him across the finish line. But, you know, I got threats against my children. So I do need support in the fight.
And we will support you. Absolutely. We got to leave it there. Stacey Langton, thanks so much. And we'll be right back with more. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then, they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as Donald Trump has made his flurry of appointments, that it's almost like every time that you refresh your phone, there's, you know, some other announcement that he's made another appointment, which is kind of a brilliant strategy, actually, because then the media's attention isn't on just one nominee, and it's not like everybody is thoroughly dissecting every single individual. It's kind of like we have to just take them as a whole, and that may be a good strategy for him, but we do want to emphasize and focus on a couple of those picks, and one of them that I'm personally very excited about is our friend Brendan Carr. He has been part of the FCC and has been a frequent guest on this program. And he is also someone who Heritage Foundation is apparently supportive of. And Jake Denton, who is the Heritage Tech Policy Associate, posted this: America First tech policy means taking on the censorship industrial complex at its root, not just reform, a full dismantling. That's why Brendan Carr, leading the FCC, is so vital. He understands what it will take to restore the digital public square. So Jake Denton joins us now. Good morning, Jake. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the digital bill of rights that the Trump campaign championed. Now we have Brendan Carr at the FCC. What does this actually mean in terms of overall tech policy?
Yeah, good morning. I think this is one of the more significant picks, hasn't been discussed too much, but it really highlights the Trump camp's commitment to undoing what has really kind of taken shape over the last better part of 8 years with the censorship industrial complex. And I think there's still an impression amongst the American people that, you know, a lot of these kind of censorship incidents, whether it be deplatforming, suspensions, happen directly from the social media platform. But what we've come to find out, and what Brendan Carr knows well, is that there's an advertising cartel that really influences the way that these platforms govern content. And then there's also government collaboration. We have agencies like DHS or even the FBI communicating directly to the social media companies, telling them which platforms or telling them which accounts to take action on. And so, you know, when you take action against the complex here at the root, it means going after all of the above, not just the, you know, government involvement or the social media platform, but really the entire beast.
Yeah, and this is so important when we're looking at, you know, not only this area, but also what Doge and, you know, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy are looking at in terms of just a total dismantling of the deep federal bureaucracy and how this has taken over. And so what if anything, do we know about Brendan Carr's position on something like a digital bill of rights and how that has been framed, at least by the Trump campaign?
Yeah, I'm not sure if the commissioner has taken a stance on the Digital Bill of Rights, but I think in principle it's something he would absolutely be supportive of. just when you kind of consider the tenets of this, you know, the ability for the First Amendment to be, you know, fully enforced online, which we all think it should be, but clearly needs to now be enumerated just given the way it's been constantly abused. And then things like data privacy protections, he's been pretty outspoken on as well. You know, all of our consumer data sets have been egregiously abused by these social media platforms, whether it's your geolocation or really just your keystrokes even, all feeding into these AI models and the like, which is really just necessitates this digital bill of rights even further, because it's clear that they're not going to do what we expect them to. It has to be written for them into law. Otherwise, we'll just continue this cycle of abuse.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Jake Denton, who is the Heritage Tech Policy Associate. And Jake, you've been on this show quite a few times, and we've had a lot of discussions about, you know, AI policy and how, you know, there, it seems like a lot of perhaps, you know, the older generation doesn't really understand how much this is going to affect our culture. And, you know, people like Elon Musk are sounding the alarm. Will someone like a Brendan Carr understand that type of policy and maybe be able to take this to a Congress that still by and large is, you know, is run by the generation that is newer to tech?
Yeah, Brendan Carr is not going to have a whole lot of overlap when it comes to artificial intelligence policy. There are definitely areas where he could be, you know, influential, but this will largely be something like the Department of Commerce, the Department of Energy, these kind of agencies that are going to enable its development. I think, you know, what's really important to understand here is that pretty much every element of government will now have a role to play in either enabling or regulating artificial intelligence. Simply put, like, we don't have an AI agency, but every agency is impacted by the technology. So Trump has put together a young cabinet, people who are more familiar with technology, just generally speaking. And it's going to really take all of them to make sure that we don't fall behind China.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And to see how, you know, all of these different cabinet members and all of the agencies really do need to take an active role. I wanted to get your reaction as well to this headline that was from a couple of days ago from Business Insider. It said, ex-Google CEO Eric Schmidt says AI will, quote, shape identity, and that normal people are not ready for it. I think that some people like this are really sounding the alarm of what AI is poised to influence the culture and business. And I think it's probably true that that most of us aren't really ready for this and don't actually understand the impact. What do you think?
I think it's absolutely correct. So what he's kind of loosely referring to here is the proliferation of the technology across our daily lives. These are called, you know, AI agents. They fill all sorts of roles. They could be on your team at work handling email queries or data analysis, and they can communicate their findings to you in real time. They could be in your child's classroom as a math tutor, giving them personalized instruction. And kind of what he's referencing here is that most people don't have the kind of tools or background experience to manage that relationship in a healthy way. Some of people do in the professional space, and it'll be a huge advantage for them, but others are going to have a lot of deference to these machines. And on issues, you know, that could kind of impact the person's thinking or their beliefs, they're in a position to be manipulated. And I think the key here is to get exposure to the technology, play around with things like ChatGPT or Claude, another chatbot, and see how it works, see, you know, what it looks like to communicate with these so you can catch them out in the wild when you maybe aren't, it's not disclosed to you that you're interacting with AI.
Yeah, and these are going to be part of the tools that shape the business future for sure. And, you know, some of the highlights from this article, and, you know, one that really stuck out to me is that he also, Schmidt, the ex-Google CEO, said that a child's best friend could be not human in the future, and this part of shaping a child's identity and culture. I mean, when we're talking about culture and we're talking about tech, I mean, we've seen how much even just, you know, the entertainment industry and even kids who are so addicted to screen time and even a lot of people who kind of live in this, you know, modified avatar sort of world. I mean, I know for listeners who regularly listen to me, they know my mom is a marriage and family counselor. And one of the things that she's counseled on frequently are people who their lives and identity are in this alternate world where they play, you know, it's not just video games. It's like an alternate universe, and they're more concerned about what their avatar is doing than how successful they actually are and participating in their family in their real life. I mean, and this is something that's been going on, you know, for decades, not just in the last couple of years. And so how important is it for specifically parents to understand, who may not be as familiar with this type of tech, that this really can impact their child's future? I mean, when you talk about something like, you know, their child's best friend could be not human, I think that really raises a red flag.
Yeah, it's very important. And I think one element of this that they need to understand is that it's already happening. Meta, for instance, allows these kids to correspond with like celebrity doppelgangers, you know, coded to essentially resemble someone like LeBron James. And the child can, on Instagram or Facebook Messenger, correspond directly with them, have conversations and chats. There's another platform called Character AI, which allows the same thing to take place. And there's a recent story of a child killing himself because one of these bots prompted him to essentially, you know, do so. It was a pretty horrific story, but one that's important for parents to read so they can understand what these conversations look like and how they can manipulate the child. But I think the biggest piece here is to really take seriously the child's screen time and what the child is doing during that time. It's pretty easy to lose track of their keystrokes, what apps they're opening, what it means to be inside those applications if you're not keeping up with the platforms and how they're evolving. So don't take them at face value. They could really get into just about anything these days, and something like this could be very detrimental to their health.
Yeah, so well said, Jake Denton. And, you know, this isn't just about the classic, like, you know, parents monitoring their kids to make sure they're not, you know, accessing porn and, you know, some of these other, like, clearly overtly damaging content, but even things that could be manipulative and teaching them a worldview that's contrary to biblical instruction. And this kind of gets us to the conversation that we've also been having, Jake Denton, about TikTok. And, you know, Donald Trump has kind of been, I would say, a little bit back and forth in terms of supportive or not of a TikTok ban. What about that has he signaled in his campaign, and also Brendan Carr, in terms of, you know, potentially that that sort of policy and where that's headed with the current lawsuit going on?
Yeah, well, President Trump obviously used TikTok. It was very successful for him on the campaign trail, but in many ways, he was forced into that. You know, the Harris campaign using that tool really forced his hand, because you can't seed a platform of 100 million Americans, particularly in swing voter demographics. So he was put between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, I don't think he wanted to do it, but he definitely he was successful on the platform. And a lot of people interpreted that as, you know, he's going to come out in defense of the platform. But you have to remember that the piece of legislation that President Biden signed will forced divestment just here in the next month or so, towards the end of January, right near or after inauguration, leaving very little time for President Trump to intervene. And so I think a lot of the speculation around his position on this is propaganda from ByteDance. You know, they're trying to condition the public to believe that he's going to come in and save the platform. And so just kind of be weary of that, I would say. I don't know how much of that is real. A lot of it just seems like a propaganda campaign, one that we've become very familiar with from ByteDance. And then with respect to Brendan Carr, he's been a very outspoken critic, probably one of the earliest critics of the platform, and is really critical of Chinese technology writ large, in telecom and in these hardware-type spaces such as semiconductors, being very clear about his fear of the back doors and security concerns of Chinese tech here in the States.
Yeah, and he has, you're right, been one of the biggest vocal advocates for banning TikTok. So we'll see how that kind of factors in to his role with the FCC. And so so overall, in terms of, you know, the wider spectrum of tech policy, because this touches and concerns a lot of different things, for Trump day one, what would be, in your estimation, the kind of the top few items for him to address immediately, you know, whether that's spurring Congress to legislative action, whether it's executive action, or, you know, some of these other things that he needs to focus on? What do you think are the top priorities in the digital tech space?
Yeah, I think for artificial intelligence in particular, This term, you know, the Manhattan Project for AI has been floated quite a bit. But the reality is we are falling behind China when it comes to AI development. And President Trump is coming in at an inflection point. We have to choose a path forward. And I think the first thing he needs to do is probably clear up a lot of the regulatory clutter around the EPA and the Department of Energy so we can build nuclear again and really scale AI development and the data demand so we don't fall behind China. We don't have to send data centers to the Arab states or off our shore and get stuck in another version of the same TikTok problem. And then, you know, secondarily, I think what we've talked about quite often is a digital bill of rights. You know, it's outrageous that it's taken the better part of 20 years for us to have our protections online enumerated, but that should absolutely be a first 100-day priority so that we don't have to go backwards with AI development. You know, if we're training these models on data sets that could potentially be illegal to train on, we don't want to have to press the undo button. And so I think that type of thing is critical. Clear up the regulatory clutter, allow us to, you know, scale, reach the future that we're destined to, but also protect us so that, you know, it ends up being a great future and not one that we dread.
Yeah, that's so well said. And, you know, it's kind of this balance between having bureaucracy clunky enough that it can't move too fast, that it goes and just bypasses, you know, kind of the legislative quagmire that, you know, even people like the late Justice Scalia said, you know, was a good thing to have, you know, kind of this power, contradicting power, but also be able to move fast enough that it can address some of the problems of our time. And so, you know, all of this is really important. And last question for you, Jake Denton, as well. You know, is there anything from the Biden era that is, you know, a bad policy that Trump could just day one kind of roll back? Because we've talked about this in the sense of HHS and, you know, some of these other things that that Trump could immediately on day one just reverse in terms of Biden's bad policies or that conservatives would characterize as bad. Is there anything in this space that Trump could just day one say, you know, we're rolling back or we're doing different?
Yeah, I think the first and foremost should be the Biden executive order on artificial intelligence. It was potentially catastrophic for our country when it comes to competing with China. It just put a lot of uncertainty around the AI developers and has pushed them in the wrong direction. They're not pursuing what they need to. They're pursuing, you know, bureaucratic compliance. So that's the first thing. And then I think second would probably be the AI Safety Institute. It's this kind of woke DEI school of AI engineers, AI ethicists that are trying to make the models as woke as possible. And that is obviously going to end in a terrible spot for us when we talk about influencing our beliefs and these types of things around AI. We don't need bureaucrats in Washington trying to make them students of the woke movement. So that would be the second thing for me is we just need to get rid of that. It should not exist. And I think it's one of the worst things that has come from the Biden administration that doesn't get talked about too much.
Yeah, well, well said. Well, I hope that the Trump transition team is listening to all of these important insights from the Heritage Foundation. Always appreciate you dropping by, Jake Denton, and you can follow him at RealJDenton on X. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we're talking about Trump's cabinet picks and some of his appointees, because that's really the biggest news in the national conversation right now with all of this flurry of so many appointments. And, you know, what do we think and what should conservatives think? And there's a great blog over at WeThePatriotsUSA.org. My friend Brian Festa, who is the co-founder of that great organization, and it's titled The Complacency Problem. And I think this is really important to underscore. It starts like this: with the national election in the rearview mirror, we're seeing a lot of celebrations from the pro-freedom crowd these days. After President Trump's landslide victory and Republicans gaining control of both chambers of Congress, the general consensus seems to be that our worst days are behind us. Some are even declaring victory in the war against deep state corruption, even though the president and the new Congress have yet to be sworn in. So, for example, when Trump announced that he was appointing RFK Jr. to the post of HHS secretary, the health freedom community rejoiced that Big Pharma's days of absolute control and immunity were finally over. But this blog goes on to say, you know, maybe we are a little bit prematurely rejoicing, and we can't get too complacent. So Brian Festa joins us now. And obviously, Brian, you know, your organization focuses a lot on health freedom, medical freedom, but I think the overall point of what you describe as the complacency problem is very apt for all of us, especially conservatives, to recognize that we can't just say, okay, you know, our work is done, and kind of sit back for the next 4 years.
Yeah, good morning, Jenna. Thanks again for having me. Always a pleasure. But yeah, you know, I have spent, as you said, many, many years in the health freedom space. And what I was noticing coming up everywhere on social media was a lot of these posts from people that I've known for years that have been in this fight, some of them for decades. And I get it, because a lot of them are moms that have been fighting for their vaccine-injured children, that have been fighting for the truth to come out about corruption and fraud at the FDA, at the CDC. They never thought in a million years that someone like RFK Jr. would have a chance to be in a presidential cabinet and have a position of power over the Health and Human Services, 13 different agencies, actually, HHS has authority over. And so they are hailing this as what an answer to prayers. And I'm not saying it isn't. But what they're saying is that this is what we wanted for so long, and now it's finally here. I can breathe a sigh of relief. I'm crying tears of joy is what I'm hearing. It's finally over. The pharma's coming down. Everything's going to be, all the corruption in the deep state, these agencies is going to be rooted out. We're safe now. And that is the most dangerous, dangerous way of thinking possible, to believe that because Donald Trump is elected and because RFK Jr. supposedly is going to be in charge of Health and Human Services. And I say supposedly because I don't believe it's a done deal, that we can sort of rest on our laurels now. It's complacency. And I think what's going to happen now is there's going to be, especially when we're talking about health freedom, we're talking to the pharmaceutical industry, there's going to be massive pushback, and it's already happening in the Senate. Anyone who thinks that just because Republicans gain control of the Senate, that's it, all of these picks are getting confirmed, doesn't really know how Congress works, doesn't really know how lobbying works, doesn't really understand the corruption in the D.C. swamp. I know you understand it, Jenna, but I think a lot of people are naive in that respect, and they don't understand how many of these people are bought and paid for it.
Yeah, so well said. And I think it is a really good admonition to listeners that while, of course, in the short term, we can say, we can breathe a sigh of relief and say, okay, at least we have Donald Trump, who was elected instead of Kamala Harris. I mean, that is a victory in and of itself, because it stopped what her administration would have ushered in. But that doesn't mean that the fight is over. And I think one of the lessons from 2016 is that so many of conservatives and very, you know, well-meaning, engaged patriots who were very much for this whole idea of federalism prior to 2016, then when they saw, you know, Trump accomplishing a lot, which was great, it was almost like we said, oh, you know what, maybe we don't actually need federalism now, and maybe we can just rely on the federal government. And so I think even from a 30,000-foot perspective, not just what you're talking about with, you know, all of these fights that will still happen at the federal level, we can't forget that, you know, that even if the Trump administration goes 100% perfectly in the way that we would all hope that it would, which of course it won't, because there will be those battles, even then it's important to recognize that there are still fights that have to happen on the state and local level. I mean, even like, you know, I was talking to Stacey Langton, who's, you know, a mom that's fighting against, you know, porn in schools. I mean, those are local battles. Talking about, you know, things like here in the state of Florida, where we just thankfully voted down amendments over ridiculous extreme abortion amendments on the state level. And so, you know, conservatives have to understand that just because President Trump is going to be in office again, it doesn't mean that now we just sit back and say, oh, okay, now the federal government's going to take care of everything. So we have to emphasize federalism as well. But we also do need to understand, as you rightly pointed out, Brian Festa, that this is still going to be a huge battle, specifically for HHS. And I think that RFK, if he actually does what he has said he wants to do, you're right that Big Pharma is not just going to go quietly. I mean, these types of powers that have moved in Washington for a really long time are not just going to go quietly. What do you think his chances are with this current Senate, especially, of actually getting confirmed, if it goes that far? I mean, it may be a recess appointment.
Yeah, I mean, I did hear that a lot of these appointments would be recess appointments, and in some ways I think that's probably wise, but I still don't think that it's an easy path to confirmation, because these so many of these senators have been in Congress way too long. I'm an advocate of term limits. I'm not talking about the organization, because we're a nonpartisan organization at We the Patriots USA, but personally, I am an advocate of term limits. I just think that when you're in there so long and you've had your pockets lined and your hands greased by lobbyists, by industry lobbyists for that long, it's very, very hard to vote against those industries that have taken care of you for so long. And let's just face it, I'm not going to be a conspiracy theorist here, but we all know that there's blackmail, there's threats, there's dirt that a lot of these pharma overlords, or whatever you want to call them, have on a lot of these senators. So I can't see it being an easy confirmation. I think Bobby knows that. I haven't spoken to him about this. You know, I'm leaving him alone these days because he's extremely busy. But, you know, there's going to be massive pushback regardless. Let's say even if he gets confirmed, you have to remember, people listening, I want them to remember that even all these states that went for Trump, these so-called swing states that went for Trump, it was a massive landslide victory. I don't think most of us expected it to be this huge. But even in those states, those supposed swing states, you have very, very far left governors and other public officials that are running those states. So if you don't think for a minute that they're going to double down and push back even harder, then you're just not paying attention, because that's what's going to happen. It's going to be a showdown between the federal government and the states. All of these states that used to say, just trust whatever the CDC says, trust whatever the FDA says, if Kennedy is in charge, they're going to start saying, no, trust what our local state officials say, and they're going to start passing legislation even. For instance, with regard to vaccines, which obviously I've been involved in for a long time, they're going to say trust only the recommendations of the California Department of Public Health. They're going to actually put it in legislation. I wouldn't be surprised if they did, to say that you can only follow the guidelines of the California Department of Public Health. Here's the out that Republican senators have, so they don't get blasted over this, even though they still will. They can just turn to the abortion issue. Kennedy has said, and in past interviews, that he supports a woman's right to choose. At one point, he even said up to full term. All right, he changed that stance later because he got a lot of heat from it. He then said viability, but he, at one point, we know he's a lifelong Democrat. He's a Kennedy, come on. And he has said that he supports abortion. Lila Rose is already pushing back on that big time. I just read an email from her that she sent this weekend to me. I mean, that's what they can use. That's what these conservative or even rhino senators can use as cover not to confirm him.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. And, you know, it is going to be very interesting to see how much, you know, Kennedy, if he is confirmed, you know, whether it's through the Senate or the recess appointment, can actually get accomplished with respect to, you know, a lot of these initiatives that he has at least said that he wants. And, you know, and speaking of abortion, I mean, that is a really difficult topic, because you have a lot of these people that that are like Kennedy, that Trump is appointing, who aren't necessarily staunch pro-lifers. And that violates a lot of the ethic that, of course, the evangelical and Catholic voters turned out and obviously supported Trump over Harris, but still expect that from the federal level, like, for example, the Mexico City policy, that Trump would on day one reinstitute that and say, you know, no, our taxpayer dollars aren't going to fund abortions and some of these things. So there's going to be some, you know, contrast and conflict. But you're also right, Brian Festa, about, you know, these state governors who definitely aren't conservative, and that's including even some of the red state governors, but especially the blue states have already said with respect to things like the mass deportation initiatives that Trump says he wants to implement, that they're going to they're going to just say, you know, no, we're going to push back on this, and we're saying that, you know, we're not going to allow Trump's DHS to come in here and do the mass deportations. And so if that was a Republican governor against a, say, President-elect Harris, can you imagine the outrage from the liberal leftist media saying, how dare you go against the policy of a sitting president? Yet I think we're going to see a lot of that, and it'll ultimately end up in court. So, you know, you're very familiar with the court battles. How do you see a lot of these moving forward if they get all the way up to the Supreme Court on some of these things like medical freedom?
Well, that's why organizations like ours, not only ours, there's a lot of great organizations that are doing great work, need to be able to continue to do their work. And that's why I tell people, please continue to support We the Patriots USA, wethepatriotsusa.org, as you're considering your year-end tax-deductible donations, because we need to be fueled. We need to be ready to go into court. The second President Trump issues any kind of executive order that people in that governors in these blue states, or even in these supposed swing states like Michigan and Minnesota, the second he issues an order they don't like, there's going to be a lawsuit filed. And all it takes is one federal district court judge to issue an injunction to halt that. And then it's tied up in litigation for months, maybe even a year or more. Well, guess what's going to happen in the interim? In only 2 years, we'll have another less than 2 years, and probably only a year and a half by the time, you know, President Trump really gets, you know, started and implement his agenda fully. You're going to have another election, another congressional election, where the balance of power in the Senate and Congress could shift again. So he has a very, very small window of time to even do a lot of these things, and then. Executive orders, as we know, many of them, even if we love what he's trying to do, are not constitutional because there are powers that are reserved to Congress only. He's talking about pulling funding from all of these schools, pulling funding for education that's given to public schools if they mandate vaccinations. That sounds great, but that taxing and spending power is reserved to Congress. People are saying, even people that I really respect, I've heard on interviews recently saying President Trump needs to repeal the 1986 act that gave vaccine manufacturers immunity from liability. He can't do that. Only Congress can repeal an act of Congress. So again, there is a very large uphill battle here, and we need to be ready to go into court immediately as soon as these laws are challenged, or if there are good executive orders that are constitutional. As soon as they're challenged, we need people on the other side to defend the good laws, to defend the good orders, and to fight any bad ones coming, especially out of these blue states and swing states. I think it's going to be a dogfight. I think the country, it doesn't look like it's divided. When you look at the Electoral College votes, it looks like everyone, almost everyone is united behind Trump. But the people in power in those states are not united behind him, not by a long shot.
Yeah, and that's such another excellent point, Brian Festa, that, you know, Trump can't do this alone. And thankfully, our Constitution doesn't vest all powers in one chief executive. We have a separation of powers, but that then requires Congress to act and state governors to act and, you know, all of us to be engaged and actually take self-government very seriously. And that's why organizations like WeThePatriotsUSA.org, you can find them, WeThePatriotsUSA.org, are so important to make sure to mount these legal challenges and that we continue to participate at every level of government to fight for what is best policy and ultimately for the freedoms that our Constitution provides. So Brian, always really appreciate your insights. Keep up the great work. Again, you can find him at WeThePatriotsUSA.org, and you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. I will see you tomorrow morning.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.